why wait in line for the PlayStation 3? What are some of the features that you're looking forward to?
Tell you the truth, the hackability. I'm not going to lie, the hackability. I want to get into the system as fast as I can and do whatever I can since it just came out. Probably has a couple of bugs I can exploit and whatnot.
Some marketers have been trying to get the Christmas shopping season to start on Halloween. Hasn't worked so far. The closest they've come happened yesterday when Sony released its latest version of the PlayStation at midnight on Friday. We've got that story plus a look at open source software gaining ground, the U.S. government's continued attempts to get their IT stack secure and by extension securing your privacy, and a follow-up on the disaster of e-voting. This is PodTech News for Saturday, November 18th, 2006. This is PodTech News. I'm Jason Lopez. Sony's PS3 launch attracted hundreds of hardcore gamers to the Metreon in San Francisco, where Sony has a flagship store. The PS3 didn't just attract them. They waited outside the Metreon for days. Apparently, the wait was too long. The first person in line who bought the first PS3 on Friday at midnight threw up. It's a long story. PodTech's Rio Pacino was there.
This is Rio Pacino for PodTech.net. I'm here at the Sony store outside of the Metreon where the countdown has finally gone down to zero. The Sony PlayStation 3 is now for sale. In fact, the first set of people have already been allowed into the Sony store. And the first person, Chris from SF, is actually outside here right now. And he has already purchased the Sony PlayStation 3. And we'll go ahead and try to get a quick 5 minutes with him right now. Hey, Chris, man, any chance you could do a quick podcast?
I'm out. This way, guys. Really? Welcome to SFUS.
All right, guys, congratulations.
He was almost throwing up.
Right. Well, no, actually, oh, my God, he's getting escorted out in a limo.
Okay, so I didn't get to interview Chris after all, which kind of sucks since I've been waiting there for hours on end hoping to get an interview with Chris. However, I'm not one to complain as, you know, there are people in line waiting for days for the PlayStation 3. So if anybody has a right to be upset or complain about being tired, it's those people in line. However, I did find the limo that Chris was in a couple blocks down from the Metreon. However, Chris was not inside the limo. He was across the street dealing with some business. Apparently, he was a little under the weather for waiting in line for so long. But the other people in the limo, the second, third, and fourth guys in line waiting for a PS3, were still inside the limo. And they invited me in and actually had a chance to speak with them about their experience. You guys got swept out on a limo. Go ahead and tell me what number you guys are.
I'll just pick a random number. I guess I was 3.
I guess I was 2.
No, I was 4.
How long were you guys waiting in line, man, for this PS3?
40 hours or so, I think.
Yeah, since Wednesday at 8, so yeah. Whatever that
yeah,
is.
Yeah, Wednesday at 8, and then it's like 12, Thursday at 12 in the morning right now. So.
Are all of you guys friends, or are you guys just met in line?
No, we're all friends.
We
all planned it like in a couple like 10 minutes.
So we didn't plan this limo, so we're sort of we don't know what we're gonna do now. Yeah,
we're kind of dumbfounded because you know we weren't expecting this.
Oh no, I wasn't expecting it either. You know, but it has to feel good. I mean, it has to be worth the wait considering that you guys were there since Wednesday.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm just hoping I don't get fired my job. Leaving a limo, I think they'll let me go.
Hey, they'll understand, man. I'm pretty sure they understand once they see you on TV or something.
Yeah.
Now, what are you guys going to do with the PlayStation 3? I've been like interviewing people left and right, and the majority of them say they're going to sell it on eBay or online. What are you guys going to do?
I think we're going to keep one console and sell the rest.
Yeah, I mean, for most of us are college students, and we don't have that much money. But, I mean, since we're all friends, you know, we only really need one console.
Yeah, we all play with each other.
Cash the extra
Cash the extra consoles out, you know?
Exactly.
Right. Why wait in line for the PlayStation 3? What are some of the features that you're looking forward to?
Tell you the truth, the hackability. I'm not going to lie. The hackability. I want to get into the system as fast as I can and do whatever I can since it just came out. Probably has a couple of bugs I can exploit and whatnot. Yeah.
How about you guys?
I don't know. I mean, the Blu-ray technology, you know, there's a lot of new technology in the PS3 that's commendable.
Same. Everything they both said, that's what I want.
Gee, there's one more thing, too. The Wi-Fi capability with the PSP.
Oh, yeah.
You have the PS3 sure, right yeah. there. You got a PSP over here. There's a Wi-Fi connection. You can watch movies off the hard drive onto your PSP.
And I know about that, and I'm aware. I'm actually pretty jealous of you guys because I wish I was one of the top five in line, but unfortunately I'm not. Now, it looks like here, did you guys buy more than one system each?
No, we bought one system each.
If we could, we would have bought more. But
yeah, they don't let us.
Are you guys looking at maybe purchasing a Wii or a 360, or do you guys already own a 360? Any of you guys?
We're going to get Wiis, all
yeah,
of
we're
us.
We're going to get Wiis for sure.
Wiis.
Speaking of the Wii, Nintendo is also hosting a launch party for its new console tomorrow. Prior to all the madness going on inside and outside of the Metreon, I had a chance to sit down with Sony Public Relations Manager Patrick Siebold, and he talked about the importance of having a successful launch, some of the rumored problems with the PlayStation 3, and his thoughts on the Nintendo Wii.
Certainly, PlayStation 3 is a linchpin product for Sony in general. But you know, Sony's overall had tons of success with products across the board, from movies and music, PlayStation being one of them. So while it's an important product, certainly we're excited to get this first sale underway.
Now, I've heard numbers as far as how many PS3s will be available at launch. 400,000 in the U.S. was the official number.
That's correct.
However, reports came out yesterday saying the number of systems was, I think, 150,000 to 200,000.
No, those numbers are not true. I have not, we won't know the exact shipment numbers until really at the end of day to day when we actually see them on shelves and in retail. But we are certainly on track for our target of 400,000, as you mentioned. And then also we're air freighting in 100,000 units a week between now and the end of the year. The second they come off the line, they're coming in so we can meet that demand.
So any sign of a shortage through the holiday season is probably something that's not going to happen?
Well, the demand is certainly there for PS3. And like I said, we're shipping in 100,000 units every week. So, if that meets the demand, great. But I have a feeling those units are going to be snapped up pretty quickly. So PlayStation 3 will be one of the hottest products this holiday season, without a doubt. But we're doing everything we can to get them on the shelves.
Patrick, what are the projected numbers for this holiday season and into 2007? Do you know that off the top?
Projected numbers, we're really hoping to get a million units here in the States by the end of the calendar year, so December 31st. And into 2007, we're just going to continue to ship as many units as we can possibly make to get them on shelves. And as we talked about, the demand is there, so I think those units are all going to sell pretty quickly.
Now, one of the things I wanted to talk about was the PlayStation Online Store and online in general.
Sure.
Xbox Live is a very, very strong online thing going on with the Xbox Live service.
Sure.
Not much has been said about PlayStation's online service. What can you say to those who want to know more about it?
Well, certainly. I mean, you're right. Xbox Live is, up until now, been the de facto standard for online gaming and online downloadable content. Purely, we had just not have had our store up and running yet, but we're really excited about it. There's going to be a lot of downloadable content in terms of games, movies, trailers, pictures, everything you could really want to download to your hard disk drive on the PS3. So come midnight tonight, I think there's going to be a lot of attention paid to those servers when people get those units online. And
are there any surprises coming in store for the online?
I wouldn't say there's any real surprises right now. I think we've gone out and kind of said what we're going to have, which, is, like I said, is the movies, trailers, music, and games, and everything else. I think people are going to be surprised when they actually get on there and play and see the quality of the games that are going to be downloadable. I mean, Blast Factor is one of the first ones we're going to have available tonight, and I spent some time playing it the other day, and to be honest, the time flew by. It was one of those kind of games you can get for fairly cheap. I think it's under $10, and you can just sit there and play that thing for hours and hours and hours. So I think
online's free with Sony.
Is free to play games. Online is free, of course. To download games like Blast Factor, there is a fee to do it. But if we're going to go and play, let's say, a game like Resistance, which is one of our launch titles online, there's no fee for that at all, and you'll be able to surf the web and all that stuff for free.
Is every single game, downloadable game, on the PlayStation Store, are all of those games going to be 1080p?
That's a really good question. I don't know that answer right now. I'll have to actually look it up. I know Blast Factor for sure is, and that's, like I said, the first one that comes out that I've actually played, but I haven't seen all the rest, so I'm not sure.
talks of Sony PS3 user-created content. Have you heard about that?
We've actually talked about it in the past in terms of user-created content, and there's actually not anything in set in stone for it right now as of day one, but certainly in the near future we're evaluating exactly what that's going to mean, if it's going to be creating levels in games and be able to distribute them to other users or not. Mm-hmm. That's certainly something we're thinking about right now.
Similar to Microsoft's XNA?
Perhaps, yes.
Okay. Let's talk about backwards compatibility.
Sure.
There have been reports that there are a couple hundred games that aren't.
That's true.
Now,
we aim to be 100% backwards compatible, and I think that's our goal. I got to note, though, there's over 8,000 games available on PlayStation 1 and PlayStation 2 globally. And I think the report is that there's just under 200 games that aren't actually playing perfectly just yet. That's less than 2% of the library. The interesting thing is we're going to be able to fix a lot of that with a firmware upgrade coming as soon as we can get it underway. So I think the backwards compatibility, people will be surprised when they realize that 98% of the games work. If there's those 2%, we're going to do everything we can to make them work as well.
Patrick, heading into launch, into the launch date, there have been questions of overheating with the PlayStation 3 as well as with the Blu-ray diodes, that whole situation. Is that something that has been figured out and been dealt with, and is that something that consumers don't have to worry about anymore?
Actually, yeah, that's interesting on the overheating. And the reports I've heard mostly from the press that I've sent units out to, it's actually running extremely cool and certainly much cooler than the competition. And the Blu-ray diodes, we've said in the past that was part of the reason we had some manufacturing difficulties early on. And that's why we have, unfortunately, only 400,000 units, although that's a very strong quantity at launch. I think that has been corrected, and the units, like I said, we're shipping 100,000 a week moving forward, so the production is up almost at full scale right now.
That should be good news, because I have a 360, and I was one of the many who've dealt with the red light of death with their overheating problems.
Yeah.
So I think it's very important that you guys fix the problems.
It's actually interesting. I have a unit in my office. I've been playing it for maybe 8 hours. It's been on during the workday, and at the end of the day, it really is cool. I'd certainly suggest you try it out for yourself and see, but they're running pretty cool right now.
Patrick, you guys aren't the only one that's making history in gaming. There's also Nintendo with the Wii. What are your thoughts on the Wii? It's cheap price point, it's new controller. Mm-hmm. You got fanboys saying that Sony's copied the Wii with the 6-axis. What are your general thoughts on that?
To be honest, I haven't spent much time playing the Wii, so my thoughts are more just general along those lines. But they're certainly going after a different audience, I think, than PlayStation's going after. As we say, we got 700 people here lined up. That's loyalty for fans, and they're here to get their hands on the PS3. And we already talked about the backwards compatibility, but certainly the technology aspect with the Blu-ray, as you talked about, the cell broadband engine,
1080p.
I mean, there's an element that consumers are going to get with the PlayStation 3 you can't get anywhere else. And I think Nintendo certainly, the Wii will be a great product, but I just don't think it's going after the same consumer at all.
Well, 360 is a different story. They are your competition.
Sure.
It was funny when I saw the news that they were offering video downloads with HD and TV shows. I saw that as perfect timing for them to do that. With your launch coming up. What do you think about Xbox 360 and what they've done so far? Being in the market for a year now, a year ahead of you guys.
Sure. I think that year advantage is something that Xbox openly has said. They wanted that. They needed that to get ahead. I just think the interesting part is looking at the sales data now. The PS2 is actually outselling the Xbox 360 on a month-by-month basis over the last 5 or 6 months. So, they had that initial rush at launch, and that's great. It's a new consumer product at the time, and their fans snapped it right up. But once consumers realize what's around the corner in our future-proof box of PS3, which really is going to be around for the next 10 years, people realize it's going to be worth the investment, worth the wait. Like I said, that 10-year investment, they don't make the original Xbox anymore. 5 years later, they stopped making it. So the Xbox 360 kind of took over. And if you're looking at an investment for your money, you're going to want something that's going to be around for a long time. So consumers quickly realize, wow, PlayStation's a brand we can trust, really loyal to it. They make great products that are around for a long time.
So there you have it. Sony has launched its PS3. Nintendo is launching its Wii tomorrow. And the Xbox 360 is already ahead of schedule by 1 year. So for all you gamers out there thinking about buying a system, now you have a choice: Nintendo Wii, Xbox 360, or PS3. For Podtech News, I'm Rio Pacino.
There may be no such thing as a free lunch, unless you go to software conferences, but free software is closer than your corner deli thanks to the burgeoning open source movement. It's a movement that's not just for benevolent mad scientists. Big money and big corporations are getting into it as well, and expecting to reap hefty economic gains, or so they hope. Catherine Girardeau has the story.
I understand it puts a threat and puts a bit of a challenge to conventional business models, but it's a rising tide. What we want to do is we want to see more people come online, the barriers of entry be as low as humanly possible.
Sun Microsystems announced last week they're releasing the source code for the Java platform under an open source license. Java is the invisible but ubiquitous power behind a huge array of applications running on mobile devices, cell phones, and desktop computers. On the face of it, donating Java's code to the software development community looks like a bold move for Sun and a win for developers, as well as for consumers, who are likely to benefit from the increased innovation Sun hopes this move will spur. Today on PodTech News, we look at the open sourcing of Java and talk with open source guru Bruce Perens, the co-founder of the open source movement. I'm Catherine Girardeau.
The choice of GPL, I think, is going to really rock some people back. It's a bold move, and it's one that's going to have a lot of far-reaching consequences.
Sun's announcement at company headquarters started with videotaped endorsements from the open-source community.
It is an extraordinary achievement in returning programming technology to that state of freely available knowledge. Sun has now GPL'd hardware designs. Sun is GPLing Java. That's an extraordinary vote of confidence in this way of sharing information. And we, in the free software world, are very pleased and very flattered to see Sun taking its own very valuable and very important products and agreeing with us that they will be more advantageous to Sun as well as to the rest of the community if they are shared under these rules.
When Jonathan Schwartz, Sun president and CEO, took the company helm earlier this year, he promised to open source Java, a move analysts said showed his orientation toward the developer community, a departure, they said, from previous CEO Scott McNeely's orientation towards the investor community. So the question investors and competitors might well be asking right about now is this.
If you open source technology, does this mean revenue goes down?
Here's Sun's Executive Vice President of Software, Rich Green's response to Schwartz's staged question.
Volume equals value. You know, it's the fundamental tenet of the software business, which is unit volume, you know, adds value to everyone involved. And certainly Sun, at the core of Java, is doubtlessly going to realize incremental economic value, as well as all of the partners, all of the members. Sun is unique in the industry in that we've been able to build an economic and open source model that really threads the needle, that really provides value for both the open source community and for our shareholders as well. And I think the fundamental or the root tenet that allows this to work is Sun is the creator of IP, right? We are not the redistributor of IP. We have a business model that is fundamentally based on the invention and value of the participants inside Sun and now incrementally outside Sun. And so we have to separate that general statement from the specific, which is the IP is clean and safe and owned by Sun, now donated to the community. And there's no risk, there's no issue of having to pay others for the right to distribute that which we've created ourselves.
I asked Bruce Perens about Sun's economic motivations.
So how will Sun make money from applications created using Java?
You know, if we have to ask how is Sun going to make money from this, we have to go back to how is Sun making money from this before, which is certainly not directly. I believe that Sun was using Java to sell Sun as a platform.
Since open sourcing Java will create many more Java users, Sun stands to gain by selling more service for the Java platform and applications written for Java-enabled devices.
The idea of Java is that they wanted to have a write-once-run-anywhere platform that would facilitate their business in ways other than having a direct revenue return from that particular product.
Schwartz and Green admitted that Sun's main motivation for choosing the general public license version 2, the most open license available, was in direct response to Microsoft and Novell's recent announcement that they will find ways to make Windows and Linux interoperable. The move angered many in the free software community. Analysts saw the partnership as an admission by Microsoft that it couldn't compete with open source software like Linux. Bruce Perens.
Jonathan and company took advantage of this Novell and Microsoft announcement to say,
this is a rising tide, and it would not surprise me in the least to see a growing number of proprietary software companies express displeasure with the growing open source movement. I understand it puts a threat and puts a bit of a challenge to conventional business models, but it's a rising tide. What we want to do is we want to see more people come online, the barriers of entry be as low as humanly possible. Those that are trying to defend those barriers, they have other challenges, and it's not just Sun, by the way. I think what they're doing is they're ultimately, you know, they're fighting freedom, and I wouldn't want to be on the wrong side of that battle.
Bruce Perens.
So a whole lot of pieces really came together for them to make this decision now. I think if it had not been for the Novell and Microsoft thing, that they would have waited 6 months to a year. And, of course, Novell and Microsoft were planning to do this next year as well, and they accelerated their schedule because of the Oracle announcement. So it's been an interesting fall of dominoes.
It was clearly a massive task for Sun's legal and engineering departments to make sure the Java code was not infringing on any third party's copyrights or patents. Bruce Perens.
This is complicated because there are a lot of different pieces. They're big, and Sun has to do diligence. They have to make sure they don't have pieces that belong to other people. They have to think about, well, what's the patent implications, and do we have a cross-license or something? And are we going to put open-source developers in the position of violating a patent that we're not violating? But the important thing right here is messaging, because they've said they're doing it, and they've said that where there are encumbrances, and we're talking about intellectual property encumbrances, they will remove them.
Rich Green, Executive Vice President of Software at Sun.
Sun is unique in the industry in that we've been able to build an economic and open source model that really threads the needle, that really provides value for both the open source community and for our shareholders as well. And I think the fundamental or the root tenet that allows this to work is Sun is the creator of IP, right? We are not the redistributor of IP. We have a business model that is based on the invention and value of the participants inside Sun, and now incrementally outside Sun. And so we have to separate that general statement from the specific, which is the IP is clean and safe and owned by Sun, now donated to the community. And there's no risk, there's no issue of having to pay others for the right to distribute that which we've created ourselves.
And this is not a small change for a corporation like Sun. We're $13 billion in revenue, 35,000 employees. You know, we spend billions of dollars a year on R&D. And I think it has been a bit of a cultural change inside of our organization to say the membrane has to be porous between what we build here and what we offer to the community. And it is a feedback cycle. If we continue to do that, our business also gets better. That's a tough thing for a for-profit corporation, you know, at the scale of Sun to really do. We're the only company in the industry that's really, you know, done more than simply embrace open source as a vehicle for press releases, but instead really embrace the community as a vehicle to create new products and create new opportunities.
Schwartz called it a rising tide. Would you agree with that?
Bruce Perens.
Well, open source has been a rising tide. There's just no question of that. Open source has become the dominant in a number of niches. Certainly web-facing stuff is to a great extent open source. Apache is still the dominant web server. Firefox has made great inroads. So people are seeing that, surprise, this is a sustainable phenomenon. We can't say it's not sustainable when there's so much of it being done. So, yeah, a rising tide is floating all boats, and Sun definitely doesn't want to have a hole in the bottom of their boat.
Open source guru Bruce Perens. On Sun Microsystems' announcement last week, it's releasing Java's standard, mobile, and server edition source codes under the open source general public license. In the past, Perens has worked for Hewlett-Packard as a senior strategist for the open source operating system Linux, and has also spent many years in the animation industry, with film credits on Pixar Animation Studios' A Bug's Life and Toy Story 2. Bruce is currently a VP at Source Labs, where he spends most of his time as an open source leader. In Menlo Park, I'm Catherine Girardeau, PodTech News.
This week, news broke that the Internal Revenue Service is the latest U.S. federal agency to have laptop computers lost or stolen. Some of those laptops contain sensitive information, such as Social Security numbers. Then there are the external security threats. There are reports that the Chinese military have been hacking into U.S. government systems. All in all, it paints a grim picture of IT security within the federal government. Earlier this week, a conference was held to discuss these IT security matters. From Washington, D.C., PodTech's Clark Boyd reports.
The Security 2006 conference featured panel discussions with ominous names like Critical Infrastructure Protection, The Expanding Insider Threat, and Celebrity Deathmatch, Security versus Compliance. As government officials, security experts, and business people mingled, they had one thing on their minds: how to better secure America's critical information systems. To get a sense of what kinds of technologies are currently being used to do this, I walked the exhibit floor. Large companies and startups alike are leaping headlong into the federal IT security space. One of the first people I met was Anthony Alves, a senior systems engineer for Core Security Technologies. Core makes products that can automatically test a network's susceptibility to outside penetration. I asked Anthony why the U.S. government, with all of its resources and IT experts, would be interested in a product like that.
Information warfare is the new front, so this allows people to be more proactive and actually expand that from taking the experts and the very high-level people that are few and far between that are able to do this on their own to bring this down to a more common user level.
Has it been your sense, because I've done a lot of stories about cyber defense, information warfare, a lot of people out there are skeptical about how big it is, whether it's really as bad a threat as some folks say it is. What's your sense, having worked in it?
Well, it's one of those things that you don't actually see unless it hits you right in the face. And as more and more people start getting hit in the face with it, they really start to see it. So it really is becoming a reality. You're seeing more and more in the last year folks reporting credit cards being stolen, laptops being disappearing. So it's definitely much more in the news, much more higher profile.
Not far away from Anthony was Peter McDonald from Verisept Technologies. Verisept makes a range of products that protect against insider threats.
Government is very concerned about personal information, both its employees and citizens. So what we do for the government is we stop the agencies from accidentally or employees from maliciously losing personal information, social security numbers, identities, that kind of thing, through webmail, email, instant message, peer-to-peer file transfer, that kind of thing.
Is this a big issue?
It's a huge issue. It's an issue that is landing on the front page of the Washington Post, and any issue that lands on the front page of the Washington Post is an issue in D.C.
McDonald says the software can monitor machines for infection, for inappropriate use, and for data loss.
If I love peer-to-peer, and I know my agency doesn't allow that, but I got a couple songs that I want, and I've accidentally set up my laptop inadvertently so that it allows full access to my peer-to-peer community of everything on my laptop, then the government's just created this huge back door that they don't know about. And all of that is really putting at risk kind of the core of the agency, a lot of the information that it collects, because our government collects information and provides services to our country and its citizens.
This insider threat is interesting because there is a lot of talk about how the real threat here is still the social engineering threat. It's the people and not necessarily the technology.
Well, it's absolutely the case. I mean, you go to a website, you know, you click on an OK button and you may not know it, but inadvertently a Trojan horse came down that's a keylogger that's sending, you know, a stream of everything that you're doing. There's a great story, Oregon Department of Revenue, you can look it up, where an employee after hours was looking at adult content. You know, through that process of looking at adult content, a Trojan keylogger was downloaded into his particular machine, and for 6 months was sending information out. Those social engineering issues are key, and we're the kind of tool that can see that to stop a major leak of, you know, national security or personal information or citizen information.
And that insider threat, you've had that from government clients as well.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, pick your agency of choice, and, you know, DOT has on the order of 70-plus thousand employees at least. You know, Homeland Security, 122,000. If you just work the, if you look at the statistics of it all, yes, I trust these employees, but do I trust them implicitly with all the sensitive information that's there? You have to ask that question, that second question, differently than just a blanket trust on the first question.
How big a market does the government represent for your company?
Government represents a big market for almost every IT company. It's a $60 billion yearly purchaser of IT. It's a big market.
The government's needs to protect data are not limited, though, to just computers. Access and personal identification are huge issues. Under new regulations, all federal government employees will have to carry a smart card for ID purposes. But the cards must be protected and shielded with a special sleeve, says Scott Lee of HyperDog Technologies.
The card, contactless portion of the card, is open to what's called skimming. Someone could walk past you with a card reader. It would ping your card, activate it. The card would send back information, which could be used to access systems, buildings, whatever. So it's required that with each card issued, it comes with a shielded badge sleeve. We've designed the sleeve.
The fact that you've come up with this leads me to believe that it really is a real threat, that people would walk by with a card reader and try to do this. How easy is it to get a hold of a card reader?
Well, you can purchase a card reader over the Internet for $150, $100. You could plug it in, walk around in your pocket, just walk through a crowd of DOD folks picking up card information. So it is very real.
And have there been instances when that's actually happened?
In a theoretical sense, these cards are designed so that you can't read the information farther away than 4 inches. But if you were to use a reader that boosted that signal and directed it, they have built systems that would pull the information away from, you know, 50 feet.
And the shield itself, can you talk a little bit more about what goes into making that? Is it all that complicated? Or
the principle behind it, I guess, is fairly technical. It literally is a metallic material that's embedded within the plastic, and it's transparent enough that you can use it on the exterior and still see the card, see all the features of the card.
I can see why the government would be concerned about somebody coming by and getting that kind of information. Yeah.
Most of that type of information is encrypted, but still, you know, if you can build it, somebody can crack into it. You know, nothing's foolproof.
Defensive systems weren't the only things on display in Washington. Adobe's Dean Pianta told me about possible uses for flash video systems in the Customs and Border Patrol.
This is where we set up, not a fence necessarily or a wall, but we set up 19 stations across the Mexican and U.S. border. Now, flash video can be used to simply point down and, as soon as it senses movement or sound, be turned on. Very good codecs allow us to be extremely bandwidth efficient. Technologies like Flex allow us to create dashboards to monitor 16 or 19 video feeds. Increased use of one, send that through Flashcast, actually a technology we use in the mobile and device technology. Let's send that video down to a cell phone or a small device. Someone who's maybe in the field, you know, and in government we talk about more power to the edge, net-centric warfare. These types of things say I need to push capabilities more to the edge, mobile devices and so forth.
I wanted to step back for a minute and get a bigger picture perspective on the U.S. government's wants and needs when it comes to technology. So I spoke with Gerald Charles, an executive advisor for the public sector in Cisco's Internet Business Solutions Group.
If you think about what government's really trying to do in terms of protecting citizens, in terms of economic development and growing, you know, GDP for the country, in terms of response to disaster, in terms of healthcare, all those are major issues that our government's working very, very hard on, and we're also helping to enable their enterprises. They're very, very large-scale enterprises. They deal with a lot of things in the back office, but they also deal with a lot of us as citizens in the front office with a number of the same issues. And of course, they have a, you know, maybe the world's largest workforce that needs to be enabled to do that.
What sort of tools are they asking for from companies like Cisco?
So a large number of tools, but with respect to security, security tools are really focused on, one, they want to protect the confidentiality and the integrity of data, citizen data and government data. They want to protect that no matter where a government worker may be or where a citizen may be as a citizen tries to do business with the government. So probably what's most unfortunate is you hear in the news about laptop theft. You know, frankly, you hear quite a bit about that. And laptops may have a lot of citizen data or government data on that. That does need to be protected, so no question about that. But probably really the bigger issue, and that's maybe been a little bit blown out of proportion, the laptop theft blown out of proportion, is how are we doing business with our citizens and with the suppliers to the government, and how can that be done securely? And how can we protect the intellectual property? There's a competitiveness issue. We are in a big global economy. Those probably really are the larger scale things and security issues that the government is dealing with. And they're looking more and more for tools to help them do that, to help them manage that large infrastructure and manage that large complexity much more easily.
IT, though, can be a tough sell in Washington these days. Think of all the money going to Iraq, the so-called war on terror, Katrina relief, and dozens of other big-ticket, high-profile items. But the government is reliant on computers and networks as never before. From soldiers in the field to bureaucrats at the Department of Agriculture, machines and connectivity are key.
Security is always going to be in a limelight. The mission is not going to get done without computers. And when you have a problem with your computers, your mission is going to be impacted.
Jim Lichko writes about IT issues in government. He says the real trick is getting U.S. federal agencies to take a holistic approach to security.
The biggest challenge is balancing all the pieces of security, not just throwing technology at it. A lot of times we try to solve something by throwing technology. It's finding the practical individual that can guide the agencies to, yeah, you can put a firewall here, you can put encryption here, but over here, just lock the door.
Sounds like good advice for any computer user, government employee, or no. For PodTech News, this is Clark Boyd, Washington.
Customer service. What a concept. Customer. Service. A new study shows that banks are still grappling with those words. Michael Klinger says throw in the word website, and you have the tech stat of the day.
A new study shows that bank websites are giving short shrift to customer service. A mere 20% of the space on banks' homepages goes to service and related features like help with account access, tutorials, and search. On the other hand, an average of 45% of bank homepages is devoted to pitching customers on more stuff that costs money. This is heartening news in a world increasingly dominated by the tyrannical idea of improved customer service and intuitive graphical interfaces. According to survey taker Vox, the study seems to show a disconnect between the priorities of customers and those of banks. For example, only one of those groups wants to wring even more money out of customers, and it's not the customers. Luckily for banks, those websites, with their arcane terminology and esoteric offerings, are exactly what we've come to expect. Banks don't just play a role in the complexity of modern life, they're at the root of all that economic jibber-jabber. Nobody goes to the bank to have a laugh or take a break from the pressures of daily life. Banks represent the pressures of daily life. That's why we don't expect the bank to provide easy, clear, or self-explanatory experiences online. Reality is untidy. Banking is untidy. So if we want a quick and painless corporate transaction, we'll call up AOL and try to cancel our 15-year-old email subscription, not go to our bank's website. So keep up the good work, bank websites. With the Tech Stat, I'm Michael Klinger.
We have a follow-up now to our election story about e-voting machines. How did they perform this time around? PodTech's Matt Kelly explains.
It's been a little over a week since the November 2006 midterm elections. The Democrats won. The Republicans lost. But did Americans win or lose at the polls when it came to electronic voting machines? The verdict may well be a hung jury. In a follow-up to my pre-election interview with Larry Norden of New York's Brennan Center for Justice, I asked him his thoughts on the performance of the machines in the national election.
Well, what I would say is it wasn't a disaster, but a lot of the problems that I was concerned about certainly revealed themselves. And probably one of the best examples is what happened in Sarasota County in Florida, where in a congressional race on the touchscreen voting machine, 16% of the votes unaccounted for. It's hard to know exactly what happened, if there was some kind of programming error that resulted in votes not getting recorded, or if there was an issue of a bad ballot design. And I'd say that that points to the importance of having as transparent a voting process as possible.
Sean Green, research director of electionline.org, a nonpartisan non-advocacy group tracking election reform issues funded by the Pew Charitable Trusts in Washington, D.C., agrees, adding, "It depends on who you ask."
State officials generally seem pretty pleased, but you know, we've read a lot of reports here and there throughout a bunch of states. In fact, we're sort of compiling a report right now of sort of what we're calling election day incidents, where machines either had different sets of problems. Some of them were human interaction, poll worker or voter with a voting machine, but some were just voting machine malfunctions. You know, a lot of places you saw throughout the country where the beginning of election day, when poll workers tried to start up the machines, sometimes they just had problems getting them started, either by not knowing the procedure. In some places, though, there were faulty memory cards that used to start the machines that just weren't working. So you had problems like that, and those we saw reports of that across the country.
Both Norton and Green note that much of the problems on election day stemmed from the poll workers or election officials who may have been unfamiliar with the machines.
I mean, there were all kinds of problems in western Pennsylvania, in Indiana, where poll workers and election officials had troubles with the machines, and as a result, they either weren't able to start them up, or they broke down in the middle of a day and voters weren't able to use them, and the result was, unfortunately, long lines, and in some cases, voters being turned away rather than given the option of voting on paper ballots. I think that there is no question that there is an issue with poll workers becoming familiar with these machines, how to set them up, how to use them, what to do when something goes wrong.
But it is the technology itself that's also at the root of the problem, says Norton.
They run on software and they're reliant on things like having memory cards. And if there's a step missing in the procedures or if there is a bug in the software, you can have an entire polling place basically shut down, and we saw that in some places. So I'm hopeful that we'll have less of those incidents in the future, but I've said many times before, what is most important is to be prepared in case something does go wrong. In some jurisdictions they were ready, and in others they weren't. And you know, we saw in Denver not necessarily great preparation, so that you had people waiting online for hours and hours, although nobody was turned away. Explicitly, if somebody has to wait online for 2 hours to vote, there's a good chance they're not going to end up voting at all. One common complaint, and you know, there are a bunch of groups taking complaints from voters. One common complaint we heard around the country on the touchscreen machines probably can be best described as some kind of calibration problem with the machines, where after being used for a little while, the machines were not necessarily reading the voter's vote as the voter intended it. The voter may have pressed for candidate A, and the screen told them that they chose candidate B. I don't know why that's still such a problem with the touchscreen machines, but it appears to be a lot of them have that kind of problem that occurs after a voting machine is used for a little while that really is unacceptable and something that you wouldn't see on, for instance, an ATM machine. You know, I don't think that was necessarily widely reported, but it certainly got lots of complaints around the country.
So we're in a conundrum. And it all comes down to money. We spend all sorts of money on new technology, yet rely on a system of volunteer poll workers, most of whom are unfamiliar with the new technology, to make sure the systems work correctly at election time. But Norton has some ideas that might help solve the problem.
Unfortunately, we do not give enough money in this country to election administration, and election officials are generally under extremely tight budgets. There's not a lot of money given to certainly recruit poll workers who only work a couple of days a year. I don't think there's any question that there should be more money put into that kind of thing. In fact, we should be looking at other creative ways to get good people to work as poll workers, particularly because these are new machines and because in many cases they're fairly technically complicated machines. I think it would be a great thing to see more recruiting from universities, from other government offices where people have technical backgrounds. One suggestion I've heard that I don't think is a bad idea is to give some kind of continuing legal education credit to lawyers to have them work in the polling places. People who may have more experience in working with electronic machines.
Green says other solutions being floated include doing away with touchscreen machines altogether, or a bill from Congress mandating stricter guidelines, or to perhaps follow Oregon's example and vote by mail.
Well, a couple possibilities. I think there's a possibility that a few states that do, or a few jurisdictions that do have electronic voting machines, are going to get rid of them. And in fact, Sarasota County has already said they're going to get rid of their touchscreen machines and go to optical, paper-based optical scan systems. I think, you know, now with Democrats in control of the Congress, you might see more of a move there. I mean, there's certainly been a bill floating around in Congress for a couple of years now to mandate a voter verified paper audit trail on these electronic voting machines. And I think you might see that get pushed more at the federal level. It's happened at the state level, but it could happen now more at the federal level. Certainly a number of West Coast states, Washington, and I mean, Washington's almost entirely a vote by mail state. 34 of 39 counties are. California, a lot of voters vote before Election Day, either in person or by mail. I think some would argue that it is a way. There are other security issues when you put your ballot in the mail. Then there's sort of the larger questions of what does voting by mail sort of takes away from our concept of Election Day, and does that sort of take away from sort of the concept of our last day as sort of one big civic participation all on the same day. Now, I mean, the people in Oregon, and certainly the Secretary of State's office, has been lauding this for a long time, and they feel they have a pretty strong security system in place as well for their vote-by-mail system. It's really, I mean, in the end, it's really more for convenience. I mean, it's a harder argument to say that it increases turnout, because in states that have sort of no-excuse absentee voting, or like Oregon, their turnout numbers haven't jumped up.
But both Norton and Green do advocate the benefits of the new machines.
There are people who like the electronic voting systems. I mean, the advantages they have for being accessible for disabled and blind voters, from being able to do multiple languages very easily.
I've made the point for a long time that I think that these machines bring a lot of advantages to voting, and they've addressed a lot of the problems that we saw with the old systems that we had in 2000. You know, some of these machines may be better than others, and certainly jurisdictions should be doing what they can to get the best machines that are available. But just as important, whatever system a jurisdiction has, is to put the right security and reliability procedures in place to make sure that votes are secure and that they're counted as accurately as possible. I think too often the discussion in the United States around voting over the last several years has been around the technology or method that's used, and too little emphasis has been put around the procedures that are in place to make sure that things are working properly. And in the end, that's at least as important as the technology or method of voting that we're using.
Each man, however, believe the debate is far from over.
My perspective is that our goal should be no problems in the elections. It's not acceptable. Voting is a fundamental right. It is not acceptable under any circumstances that people are denied the right to have their votes counted if they have the right to vote. Given that that is my standard, I would not give it a very good grade, because we know that there are, without question, thousands, just in one county in Florida, thousands of people that went to vote and had an intention to vote and their votes were not recorded accurately. And the truth of the matter is, Sarasota County is one county in Florida. I have no doubt that if you look at the country as a whole, there are tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people who had intentions to vote a certain way and those votes weren't recorded accurately. That doesn't mean that we didn't improve over the last election. It just means that we've got a long way to go to make sure that the system works the way it should.
I think that electronic voting machines are the solution, and I think the same probably supporters of electronic voting machines, and this is going to continue to be debated up through and past 2008 probably.
For PodTech News, I'm Matt Kelly.
One note, if you want to see the furor over voting machines, go to Yahoo or Google's news sites and type in voting machines. Get a load of that tangled mess. Hard to see how the voting machine problem is going to be solved by Monday or anytime soon. This has been PodTech News Weekly Magazine. produced by Michael Klinger, Matt Kelly, Catherine Girardeau, Clark Boyd, and Rio Pacino. I'm Jason Lopez.